Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Dane Wigginton and Mick West, for joining us for this long overdue debate. I want to let you know tonight's debate is being recorded and shall not be modified in any way. It'll be for public domain. It'll be copyrighted, but shall not be modified at all. Okay. Is everybody in agreement with that?
I'm in full agreement, John.
Okay, that's Dane. And Mick?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. All right, so I want to give a special thanks to Madison Star Moon for putting this all together. And with that, we will start our conversation. All right, for my first question, we will try to keep the answers under 2 minutes. I mean, obviously, you can go over a little bit, but I'm hoping that each of you will get approximately equal time, you know, 30 minutes approximately with the 10 minutes worth of questions. Is that okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. Mick, can you tell me about yourself and why you feel compelled to do what you do?
Well, my background is I'm a computer programmer. I'm from England. You can probably tell that by my accent. And I came to America about 20 years ago, and I started a software company, which did fairly well. And about 10 years ago, I kind of went into semi-retirement. So I have a lot of spare time now. I just kind of do a bit of consulting work, and one of the things I do with my spare time is debunking, which has always been a hobby of mine. I've always found it really interesting, the science behind the claims, things like chemtrails, various other things like that, 9/11 debunking, things like that. I'm very primarily interested in the science behind it and trying to figure out, you know, why people think the way they do about certain things and how you can kind of convince them of what actually the real science is behind things, if it is in fact incorrect. Obviously, there are conspiracies that are true, so I don't just go around debunking conspiracy theories. What I like to do is focus on individual claims of evidence within those theories, like the chemtrail thing, for example. I focus on can contrails persist or not, which is a big misconception that people have. So basically, you know, it's kind of been an interest of mine. It started out more of a hobby, but now I'm taking up more and more of my my free time. And I have my two websites, which, you know, and the contrail one came first, and then I did the forum, which now I spend a lot of time on that, just kind of discussing various topics.
Okay.
That's basically it.
I'm noticing your phone is going in and out. Are you using a corded...
I have a microphone, you know, one of the, it's just an iPhone, it's the headset thing. Would you like me to try?
Okay. It's just going in and out, and I'm just wondering if it's because your bars are going in and out. I just want a really clear conversation for everybody.
Okay, I'll try moving a little bit.
Be wary of that. Okay, so basically you're into this for basically correcting people when they're wrong, I guess. Is that right?
Yes, I would say that, but it's not just simply that. It's you know, there's a greater issue here, which I think is that the things that are incorrect that people believe in are distracting from real issues. Like, there's lots of very bad things going on in the world and in our country and, you know, everywhere that are not getting the attention they deserve from some people because people are focusing on the conspiracy theories which are wrong, things like the chemtrail conspiracy theory. So I think there's more to it than just simply correcting people.
Okay. Dane, could you tell me why you feel like what you're doing is, well, first of all, tell me about yourself and tell me why you feel compelled to do what you do.
I'll make this very brief, but with a background in renewable energy, former Bechtel Power employee, home is on the cover of the world's largest renewable energy magazine, moved to the Pacific Northwest to try to find clean air when intermittent grid patterns were appearing in the skies above my home on various days, blocking 60, 70, 80% of my solar power uptake. Clearly something was going on. I dove into research, quickly came on the subject of geoengineering, which is the term we use because that is, Mick mentioned the science, and we like to use the scientific term on that, which is geoengineering. So solar radiation management, stratospheric aerosol geoengineering, began to do testing at the state-certified lab, came up with the exact same primary ingredients listed in numerous geoengineering patents, aluminum, barium, strontium, manganese, and quite simply, after examining and researching the gravity of having these materials fall down from the sky, the effect on the soils, waters, the breathable air column, and the damage to the atmosphere that's known to be caused from disbursement of particulates in the atmosphere, I felt the gravity was so immense that there was simply no greater or no more, not a more logical priority than to focus on this issue because the ramifications were so dire. So this is why I've spent the last decade plus in research on this issue and trying to educate the public on the science behind geoengineering, which is the term that leads to science.
Okay. Mick, do you do this for any sort of compensation or money?
No, not at all. Like I said, I semi-retired 10 years ago. I did fairly well in the video game industry, so I don't really need to have an income. I mean, I'm not, like, super rich, but, I don't need to pull in money. So you'll notice there's no adverts on my website or anything like that, and no one's paying me to do it.
Okay. Dane, same question. Are you doing this for money?
Not only is it not for profit, it has only been at my own expense, something in the realm of 40 to 50K in the last 10 years. So absolutely not for profit, only at great personal expense, economic expense.
Okay, that leads me into the next question. Mick, don't take this personally, but sometimes people think a little bit differently when they have children. And I'd like to know, do you have children?
I don't have children, no, but I know a lot of people who do, and I have children in my family. Not personally, so I am very concerned about the future of this planet, and that is certainly something that is in my thoughts all the time. I'm not just doing this without consideration for the next generation. I very much care about them.
And Dane, do you have any children of your own?
Two, 7-year-old, 8-year-old son, 14-year-old daughter.
So obviously both of you, I mean, maybe one more than the other has a little bit of a different feeling about how they go about their lives every day. I know I have two children, and I think continuously about my children and what the future is going to hold, and that's why I do what I do. It seems like both of you feel it similarly. But, again, having children, you see your life going beyond that. And anyway, why do you think many listeners want to know what your thoughts are on God. Okay, so, Mick, I'm going to ask you that. Faith in a mighty, almighty creator, or keeping religion out of the equation, and just asking you if you believe in God or a supreme creator.
No, I don't. I'm an atheist. I don't see any evidence for there being a God. But I don't think that really has any bearing upon the matter at hand.
That's up to our listeners to listen for.
Oh, yeah.
I understand, and I respect your agnostic kind of view or atheist view. Dane, how about you?
I do, in a non-denominational, undefined sense, John. I mean, the forest is my cathedral, if you will. But I don't believe we're alone, but, again, I respect Mick's views on his position as well. I do respect that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, let's get into the debate on geoengineering. Mick, I understand that you have an understand that geoengineering is global. Weather modification, am I right in saying that?
So the question is?
Geoengineering as a term, meaning man-made weather.
Oh, right. No, geoengineering will be more climate modification. Weather modification generally applies to more local things, such as cloud seeding. Cloud seeding is a primary form of weather modification. Geoengineering will be something like, spraying stuff into the upper atmosphere to block out the sun, or painting roofs white all around the world to reflect the sun. And there's various other proposals, but they're all just proposals at this moment. Weather modification is obviously real. That's been going on for 50 years, but geoengineering is still at the proposal stage right now.
Okay. Dane, how would you respond to that?
If we can go back and forth, I would like to ask, and Mick, you can ask me questions as well.
Okay.
On what do you base the statement that you know they are all just proposals?
All right. Well, I don't know, but I don't see any evidence otherwise. I've talked to lots of geoengineers like David Keith and Ken Caldera, and they've given me no indication that there's anything ongoing. And if you look at the evidence from, say, the Mauna Loa, I think that's how you pronounce it, observatory. There's been no real change in the solar irradiance. And there's really basically, I mean, I know you think, I mean, you claim to have various pieces of evidence. From my perspective, though, I don't see any evidence that geoengineering is ongoing. And we can get into the actual claims of evidence later.
What would you consider a global dimming figure that's not disputed in the scientific community of 22%? What do you think is causing 22% of the sun's direct rays to not reach the surface of the planet?
That's an interesting point, because global dimming has actually decreased since the early 90s. There's been lots of articles about global dimming, but if you look at the actual figures, there hasn't been a dimming effect since Mount Pinatubo. And
I would implore people to investigate that, because I think you'll find data quite to the contrary. So we can leave that there, but I would implore
people. Well, you know, I would also encourage people to look that up, because I know you bring it up quite often, and I'm quite bemused as to why you do, because really it's the science says that there hasn't been any global dimming for the last 20 years.
Actually, there's programs from or a study from almost every major institution that says there is. Now, you said that you haven't seen any evidence to the contrary, or that these programs are not going on. Are you familiar, Mick, with anything in the way of government documents that might outline something that far exceeds any, quote, local weather modification programs? Are you aware of any such government document that might indicate actual verifiable existing programs?
Not as an existing program, no. I know people obviously talk about
historically that this has gone on. Anything historically
that
the U.S. government is involved with weather modification. Is there anything that you've seen historically that would
verify that the
U.S. government has engaged in weather modification programs on a national level?
The U.S. government is involved in monitoring weather modification levels. So they're basically recording what weather modification happens and where. So in that sense, I guess you could say that they have. But the U.S. government itself doesn't actually do very much in terms of weather modification. It's mostly local governments, local water boards who actually do it, because it's all about increasing rainfall. There's lots and lots of government documents about it, because it's water, which is a very important resource. So there's lots of documentation about it, but there's no large scale federal government.
So you're not aware of anything historically, though, that the U.S. government has been involved in national weather modification programs?
I'm not aware of it, no.
Okay, I'd like to refer people to a document we found in the NASA archives from 1966, document from the Interdepartmental Committee for Atmospheric Sciences, a presidential document. Are you aware of any agencies that would have been involved in this? I'd like to go over that real quick, if I may, John.
Sure.
On this document, which people can look up at our website and elsewhere, U.S. government weather modification document from 1966, 80 pages long, existing programs at that time called and termed national weather modification programs, which amounts to, this is what geoengineering is, this is what the term implies, and these are the programs that existed as of 1966. We had Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, Department of Health and Education, Department of Interior, Department of State, Federal Aviation Agency, Council of Economic Advisors, Atomic Energy Commission, National Science Foundation, NASA, Department of Agriculture, Bureau of Budget, universities involved, University of California, L.A., Institute for Advanced Study, MIT, University of Wisconsin, UC California, Livermore, Colorado State University, University of Minnesota, Woods Hole, Oceanographic Institute. Now, these are programs that existed. This is not monitoring. These programs actually existed. So, perhaps that's a document you might want to take a look at, Mick, because
right,
these programs existed then.
I just had a quick look at it, and all it is basically a list of silver iodide cloud seeding programs.
It's actually much, much more than that, and I would encourage anybody to look, examine that document. I don't want to get caught on one point, but John, whatever your next question is for Mick or me, I'm ready to go for that.
Yeah, Mick, some of the things that you and I have actually talked about on your website, and one of the reasons why I left was because I couldn't really talk much to you about documentation. There's tons of documentation on geoengineering. Now, whether or not you use that terminology, it is modifying the weather for for some other reason. And I'm not sure if you understand that that term could be used in a broad sense, just like the word chemtrails. A lot of people hate that word. It's kind of a taboo term. What's your term? I mean, I can't even use chemtrails on my autocorrect and try to add it to my dictionary.
Right.
Yet, that word was used, I count, more than four times in official documentation. You know, the bill, H.R. 2977, I believe it was used in the United States Air Force document 1991, and it was also just recently used by a NASA scientist this year, I think it was last month, with the rocket launching in I don't remember the name right now.
Well,
I actually have it, but he actually used it as a term because he uses he basically said that they use chemtrails for certain things.
Yeah, well,
markers.
He was
I understand. I know what he was using it about, but he also used the word. So my question to you is, my question to you, Mick, is how is it that a government, Congress, and don't say that the guy was a UFO guy or whatever. It's a document that was printed and given to the United States Congress.
Yeah, it was.
Or didn't get approved. How can you say that that's not a real term?
It is a real term. It's a theoretical device, I guess. In the context of that particular document, they were using it as a space-based weapon. It was a list of space-based weapons. So it's not entirely clear what they actually meant by that because obviously
But he still used the term.
Okay, use the term. But you know who actually wrote that?
I know who wrote it, and it's not important.
It's important
that it was used in an official document,
yeah.
And so was it used in the
United States
Air Force paper.
Who wrote it, and you know
you
want to
tell me why? Why people refused? Why is that term so taboo?
Because it refers to a theory that most people think is.
It's not a theory. Let's let Mick go, John. If we're talking about that term, I honestly am.
I think it's kind of beside the point what the term is.
About that term as well, you know.
I just don't understand how that term is a legitimate term that was used by not me, but the United States Air Force, by a NASA weatherman.
The Air Force thing was the title of a chemistry manual. The NASA weatherman was talking about chemicals being sprayed from a rocket.
And it was referred to in the manual as adding fuel additives to the jet fuel. So I'm not sure, you know, there's lots of terms here that are going around, and you know, Dame was trying to bring up geoengineering. There's tons of papers and documents and patents that refer to geoengineering. So there's
geoengineering, man.
Well, let's Mick in on a specific, perhaps, John, we can go to, you know, just the ability to defend whether or not it's going on, and if Mick wants to present his position on why he thinks it's not going on, then perhaps I can present data to the contrary.
Sure, let's go there.
All right, so you...
Go ahead.
That's all right. Well, maybe we should start with the UV issue, if that's all right, Dave?
Go right ahead.
All right, now, I was looking at the figures that you posted on your website. Now, I don't know if you looked at the email I sent you the other day, but basically it looks like you are using the figure UVA/B to mean A plus B.
UV is measured, Mick, in milliwatts per centimeter squared on the meters.
Uh-huh.
They measure in the same manner, and we have 2 meters to measure the delineation between A and B. And I don't know exactly what kind of equation you're trying to build because the data is very straightforward. UVA is measured in milliwatts per centimeter squared. UVB is measured in milliwatts per centimeter squared. And UVB is about 70% of the total UV at this point.
Let me explain
your math, and you can't get it any clearer than that. So
no, just real quick.
I don't know where you're going with this.
I'll explain. You have basically there's two columns, well, three columns. There's UVA. There's UVA/B and there's UVC in that table that you have on your website. Would you agree with that?
Make your equation, Mick, because look, we measure UVA and we measure UVB, and
but
the measurements are extremely straightforward. And I don't know exactly where you're going with this.
Right. Okay.
Let me try
to explain. Like on the table, you didn't list UVB. on the table, you had a column which was labeled UVA/B, which in normal UV measurements is the UVA divided by UVB. And it seems from your calculation of the percentages, you've used that as being the sum of UVA plus UVB, and then you've calculated UVB by subtracting UVA from that, which means that you're getting a vastly higher result. And if you actually just take that as the ratio rather than the sum.
Wait. How do you determine if UVA and the combination of UVA and UVB is the same measurement, milliwatts per centimeter squared? I don't understand your explain why we can't subtract UVA from the total equation. You know, this is done by a 40-year environmental monitoring veteran. It's very straightforward. It's very simple. And by what premise do you suggest that we can't take a known measurement for UVA and deduct it for a combination of UVA and B?
Because the column you list, UVA/B, the slash means divide. It doesn't mean at.
Do you have a problem with a particular symbol? It might, you know, you're interpreting some other way. I don't know. But
yes.
The bottom
yes,
line is we have a measurement for the combination of UVA. You know, we're getting caught in semantics here, Mick. UVA
well, no,
and UVB,
I,
we have a total combined measurement. We have the ability with a very specialized meter to measure UVA
okay.
only. And that is the deduction of that leaves a remaining of UVB, and some of that even spans to UVC, which we're now getting on the ground as well, which is supposedly
right.
stopped 100,000 feet up. So make your point, because I want to get onto the fact that geoengineering is going on, but this is very straightforward math. Mick.
Okay,
it's a 2 plus 2 equals 4 equation.
All right, so I'm just thinking that maybe that you have the ratio instead of the sum, but if in fact that is correct, what I'd love to ask you is, why don't you
you're breaking up pretty bad, Mick.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Let me move my phone.
Maybe talk. Keep the mic near your neck instead of your mouth.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
It might work a little
okay.
bit better.
Right. So, assuming you're correct and that that column is actually A plus B and not A divided by B, then the numbers that you are showing are really, really incredible. They're incredibly large. You're showing UVB. At a rate which is higher than UVA, when UVB should actually be about 5% of UVA.
Some studies suggest as low as 1%, but the maximum of 5% is generally
yeah.
accepted.
I've seen around 5, a bit over isn't 5, isn't. But anyway, let's say around 5. But that's an incredible thing. I mean, that right there, I think that would be proof that something is going on. And I think if those numbers are correct, I think what you should do is demonstrate that clearly to the world. Like what you've done now, you've just put this table up and it's a bit confusing and it's not clear. So why don't you do something that would make it completely clear? Like take your meters out, go out into the sun with a video camera, and then video yourself taking the readings and show the readings close up.
That's a great suggestion. I appreciate that suggestion. We'll do that, and not just here, because we're already arranging meters for Norway, Maine, New Mexico, and Florida. So
yeah.
We'll do that in each location. We'll do that in each location. And you know, one thing that makes it quite clear that the numbers are that bad, Mick. And again, your suggestion is a good one, and we will follow that up. The bark in the Pacific Northwest is literally being fried off the trees, completely fried off to the core wood. And trees are dying everywhere up here. It takes a tremendous amount of UV to do that. Nothing grows here, which is a known consequence of excessive UV. I mean, the UV appears so staggeringly high that leaves are literally falling off the trees right now. They started falling off in July. So we see every single sign of excessive UV. Massive insect decline. We just had a U.S. Forest Service biologist survey the terrestrial insects. 90% decline, bark being burned off the trees. You can't stand in the sun here. So we believe those numbers are. We're actually trying to use conservative math, because if you take the UVA and if you calculated 5% of the UVA measured in milliwatts per centimeter squared, you would come out with 3.5. And if you,
uh-huh.
if you divide that into the 10, which is UVV, you'd get a number that's close to 3,000%.
Yeah, they're very, very high numbers. I think they're really actually might be physically impossible to get, because it's not just ozone that absorbs UVB and C. It's the oxygen in the air and
Well, Mick, why don't you do this? Why don't you tell everybody, Mick, what's your understanding on what's your understanding of what's going on with the UVB readings?
Mick's on that though. He has a point. He's correct. Mick is correct in saying that oxygen also is part of what blocks UV and UVB. But Mick, are you aware that global oxygen percentages are dropping dramatically? Are you aware of that?
No, that's rather unlikely. What do you mean by dramatic? About 25% normally, aren't they?
Yeah, I would encourage people to look that up. Atmospheric oxygen content is, in fact, plummeting rapidly, and some consider it to be the greatest threat we face. So
I doubt that would be more than 1%, though, and that's not going to make any difference to the UV absorption rate.
Just answer this question.
You're breaking up, though, everybody.
Can you just tell us what are the implications of what Dane's saying, and what problems do you have with it?
Because
I want everybody to have an equal time here.
Okay. The implications of what Dane is saying is that there's something seriously messed up with the atmosphere. And I think that he has his figures wrong, because
okay.
I do not think it's physically possible to get that type of ratio between UVA and UVB. And I think the most likely thing is just...
Hold on one second. Dane, are you taking the measurements yourself?
No, there's a 40-year environmental monitoring veteran. He's done 20 years for the government. He's about as qualified as they come in this field. And we actually ordered a second meter to confirm the calibration of the first. The meter is guaranteed to be within 4% plus or minus. Both meters are. They're both brand new. They were donated by an anonymous supporter. And, again, Mick has a great suggestion. We'll certainly do that to back up those readings. We'll put it on video. I think it's a great idea. We will definitely do that. And we'll do that not just in this location, but in Florida and Maine and New Mexico and Norway. We'll do it in all locations, no problem. And again, one thing people should look up also, Mick, and you I know you know this, that particulates in the atmosphere, I'm not pinning you into a corner, you know, to admit geoengineering or change your opinion, but the science is clear, and particulates in the atmosphere, they do have an ozone diminishing effect. So people can look that up. Again, the science that would say from geoengineering sources of study that if they did this,
it would diminish
the ozone layer radically. So anyway, those dots do connect. But anyway, Mick, your suggestion of filming is great, and we will definitely follow up on that.
Do you have anything else to add to that? I'm sorry, I'm not regulating you enough, Mick. I want you to have more conversation about that, so just go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. I think that probably covers it because I personally think that the numbers are wrong, and I think that doing this, I think basically it's the guy you've got doing the tests is just putting the wrong numbers into a spreadsheet.
What would you say, Mick, is could burn the bark off of trees on the southwest side, native trees, I mean, all over the
Northwest? I don't
know.
I think I would ask local forestry departments and see what's going on.
They're investigating the issue now as well, and
I think you see a lot worse things than that with the levels that you were talking about. You would see people
pretty bad when you have a native oak tree, for example. We've just filmed this in the forest, and this can be seen on SkyDurler. But it is bad. I agree. I mean, it's hard to fathom that it could be that bad, but it appears to be. The readings, you know, these meters are very straightforward.
Do you happen to know the model of the meter that's being used?
I believe it's Omega Instruments. I mean, there was one that specifically preferred by this metering expert, who's again continues to do it. He's still in the field right now, but he's a 40-year veteran, so I believe it's an Omega Instruments meter. And we're seeing native oak trees with the bark literally cooked off the tree down to bare wood around half, three-quarters of the tree, where there's only a strip of Cambrian layer left behind the tree. It's literally burning native vegetation like manzanita. It's singeing the leaves right off the bushes. I mean, we're seeing some absolutely profound things here. So, but your advice is well taken on filming that so that people can see that meter. I think it's an excellent suggestion, and I understand your skepticism on that. I truly do, because we were shocked as well. But we will film that and we'll put it out. So, I think that question, you know, we can maybe put to rest, John. If Mick,
I think
are you guys
Mick,
both good on that?
Yeah.
For now.
on the aluminum testing, which I know has been a concerted mix for a long time. And
yeah, I was just going to get into that.
Yeah, go ahead.
A while back, it's been a conversation on Metabunk that some of the tests that was done in Why in the World Are You Spraying? What in the World Are They Spraying? Those two movies that they basically brought out, they did some sludge testing, and there was some question about the validity of the results. So am I right, Mick? Do you have some problems
with those tests? The issue basically is that sludge contains dirt, and dirt is 7% aluminum, so you're going to get high aluminum ratings in those tests. And yet those tests were used in the film as evidence of spray.
Now, face value, Mick, again, if those tests, if that material had any contact with dirt, any form of dirt, I would fully agree with you. But this sample came from a pond that's lined with not one liner, but two. This is Firestone EPDM pond liner. It's biologically safe for fish. There is no water source into this pond except rainwater and well water. It has virtually no contact with dirt, soil of any type, kind. And that's, you know, that reading was high because it was taken near the bottom of the pond where there's some of the fish feces and so forth that are down at the bottom of the pond. But that was no less reassuring to us that sort of fish sludge should contain that much aluminum. But on that test, there's absolutely no contact with the earth in any way, shape, or form. I mean, and this is the best.
The pond is an open surface. It's a very large open surface, and the dust in the air just naturally settles on the pond. Like, there's actually, if you look at the figures for Big Lake, thousands of pounds of dirt every year settle into lakes, and that's how you get sediment.
That's a fair enough question to pose as well. This is a very unique location in that this catchment basement was very meticulously placed on the top of a forested hill in the middle of a massively forested area. We simply do not have. It's considered a filtered location by the labs. Does not have blowing dust. Period.
What is it filtered through?
It's filtered through miles and miles of very thick boreal forest. You don't have dust storms in the middle of a boreal forest. And
yeah, but you have,
what we have in every direction.
You have dirt on the ground in a boreal forest. So the water flows through this forest and into your pond. It's flowing through dirt.
Well, again, Mick, we don't have blowing dust per se. I'm not saying there's not particles in the air, but we don't have blowing dust. Well, let's take your argument further. And let's say that somehow we have a dust storm up here that you know we have not witnessed. But let's go back to strictly rain samples then that we've had up to 3,450 parts per billion. And certainly if it's in the rain, we know it's going to be in the pond. It has to be in the pond if it's in the rain.
Yeah.
So we've had tests as high as 3,450 ppb of aluminum in a single rain event. Now, what is your perspective on that much metal in rain in the Pacific Northwest?
Well,
I'm not talking about a thunderstorm, you know, something in the Sahara Desert where maybe some dust is whipped up or something. We're talking about rain over the Pacific Northwest.
I think there's two or three possible reasons why you're getting such large levels. One is that it could be that there was some dust in the air, the rain just fell through that dust. You will always get some aluminum in rain samples because there's dust in the air. And dust is basically it's dry soil and rock that has been blown into the air. The other is that you could get some kind of contamination of the sampling device. Dust could be blown directly into that device.
Now,
the third is user error, basically.
I think to blanket dismiss 60 to 70 lab tests, some taken by the state-certified lab techs themselves, which we paid them to take, some taken by U.S. Forest Service biologists.
Oh, I'm not dismissing them at all. I'm explaining the reasons why you would get those particular.
I hate to interrupt, but wouldn't that be true of anything?
Well,
there has to be a root. There has to be a base.
But let's add,
done by qualified people that took the samples.
Mick has a legitimate question. It does, but it's a legitimate question. So let me add a little bit to that. I mean, I want to clarify this. If this material had always been there, the soil pHs of the last 10 years would not have just changed 12 to 14 times toward alkaline. The aquatic insect populations would not have just declined, some 90%. And according
to
the biologists,
two issues here, though. Like aluminum itself isn't going to do anything to the soil pH. So if you're finding
the science doesn't hold up for that, not at all. If you have acidic soils and you have aluminum oxide, it absolutely raises pH. The chemistry on that is very clear. It raises pH if you have acidic soils. If you have normally alkaline soils, you're not going to see that change. But our soils here, we have a solid baseline. We have a USDA soil study, very extensive. And this is testing done in the field with USDA soil scientists. And we've seen pH changes here 10 to 12 to even 14 times toward alkaline. And that's exactly what you would get with aluminum oxide saturation. It pushes.
Right. I think there's a lot of factors that affect soil pH, and I think you're not really taking that many samples. You're taking things like in Francis Mangle's backyard, a test underneath
these tests were taken with a USDA soil scientist. It has nothing to do with Francis. This
right, but how many tests are we talking about? What is the location?
I'm sorry, Mick, you're breaking up.
Yeah, I'm wondering how many tests you've actually done of the soil pH and whether they're actually statistically meaningful.
Statistically meaningful. Just repeat again for everybody so that they can hear it. And I'm not sure if everybody heard it. How many samples did you take?
We probably have 24, something in that range. And the pH is, again, I mean, they're so astoundingly high and so consistently high, they match the rain because the rain pH, again, rain pH should be 5.4, 5.5. When we get rain pHs of 6.6, 6.8, which is 10 to 12 times higher than it should be, that high pH rain contains aluminum. We know this from about 3-4 dozen tests taken in Shasta County, about the same amount in Siskiyou County. So when the rain pH is high, almost toward neutral, there's a tremendous amount of aluminum in that rain. During the same period, we'll hear probably aircraft traffic 10 to 15 fold normal, and we see the soil pHs going up accordingly. When the rain pH is high, the soil pHs have to follow at some point.
Well, again, I think what you've got there would be a correlation between aircraft traffic and soil pH. That's what you're claiming, basically. So I think there, why?
I'm saying I'm just pointing out an observation. Our argument, the metal's coming from somewhere. It's coming from somewhere, and it's raining down on us in very copious quantities. It's definitely there. That part is really beyond dispute.
You've obviously convinced yourself of this and some other people, but I think like the problem here is why can't you convince like the broader population?
I think we are, Mick. I think we're gaining ground by the day. I truly do. I mean, I think the statistics show that. I mean, we have 20,000 people a day on Geoengineering Watch, something in that realm, and we have the whole Northern California population now is starting to connect these dots because they can't grow anything. 1 in 50 kids has autism now, a known ailment that's connected to aluminum. 1 in 3 seniors in the continental U.S. now dies with Alzheimer's or dementia, also known to be connected with aluminum. We know the aluminum is in the rain. We know it's in the air. We know it's a primary geoengineering ingredient. It's been named on film on record by David Keith. And again, with people like David Keith, if that's the premise that geoengineering is not going on for you because David Keith says it's not, I mean, he's all over the board with everything he says.
I think David Keith is actually very consistent in what he says, and I think that you have very badly misrepresented what he actually says.
Fair enough. I hear your statement. Then let me have people compare two things he has said. First, he said in 2010 he proposed dumping 20 million tons of alumina into the atmosphere annually, and his latest statement says, just 2 private aircraft could fix everything for us. So that's a pretty big span. Going from proposing 20 million tons annually to saying only 2 aircraft could do it, that's a huge span. And I personally saw emails between David Keith and a professor at Stanford asking Keith if he knew anything about human microphages, the effect on these metals, and you know, he had no knowledge of that. He admitted on the record, this is on film for people to see in Michael Murphy's film, What in the World Are They Spraying? He admitted on the record that, have we studied the effects of these materials? No. Could terrible things happen tomorrow? We don't know. And I just don't feel that's a responsible statement for a scientist that's proposing dumping 20 million tons of aluminum.
But the thing is, in those two statements that you made, they're not incompatible. You could actually dump that amount of of aluminum with just two aircraft if they made two or three flights a day with a couple of hundred tons.
How many flights a day?
Two or three with a couple of hundred tons.
20 million tons annually you could be done with two aircraft?
Two
private
aircraft. Divided by 365 divided by two is 27,000.
People should do the math on that one, Mick, because that I would challenge anybody to do the math on that because mathematically that is absolutely not even remotely possible.
It's in the same ballpark. But the point is that these are just proposals. They're ideas for like what might be done for geoengineering. These aren't things that he's actually proposing to do.
That's actually what I'm going to ask you the next question.
Okay.
As far as government conspiracies, obviously, you know, there are a lot of people that have been given confidential documents after the fact. There are many, many government programs such as MK Ultra and the spray programs that went on with where they sprayed innocent civilians with radiation. Over 280,000 people were.
They were not actually radioactive. That is just a theory.
I'm sorry, that's not a theory. I have the documentation on it.
Yes, I know, but that documentation is just based on one number being the same for two types of chemicals. There's no actual evidence of it being radioactive. That's kind of getting a bit off topic.
Wait, you're saying that so 280,000 people did not get sprayed on and die from cancer from radiation that was sprayed from the
government? They got sprayed on, but they didn't die of cancer because of that spraying.
I don't know what are we talking about geoengineering now, John?
No, we're talking about government conspiracy. If they've done this in the past on unsuspecting citizens, and
but what you're claiming isn't what actually happened, though. You're claiming that they sprayed thousands of people with radiation and then they died of cancer. That's not what happened. They sprayed people with
what
they thought.
What happened? These people basically tell me how these people got sprayed.
They sprayed zinc cadmium sulfide, which is basically, it's a substance that fluoresces, so it can be very easily detected. And they just sprayed it from planes and from boats and things, and they wanted to see how far it would blow in the wind. They chose zinc cadmium sulfate because it was detectable, but also because it was a safe substance. There's been tests done, research done now, because people got worried about it, and they found that the effect of it was perhaps the same as a bit of secondhand smoking. Now, there's a theory.
You seem to be minimalizing. Yeah, I know you want to stay on the subject there, Dean.
Yeah,
but
you can't make claims about something.
I don't mean to steer this conversation one way or the other. But basically, what you're saying is that the government has performed tests on unsuspecting citizens.
They weren't performing tests on citizens. They were testing to see how far this stuff blew on the wind. It was harmless stuff. They were not testing it.
John, if I could suggest something, in that, and Mick, instead of getting caught in a particular instance, I think if people Google that, they could decide for themselves if there has been,
that's
in fact,
a great idea.
Got documented cases of this, and I don't want Mick to feel that, you know, we're venturing off target here.
I wanted to read something. It's a theory, so let's
The point I just wanted to make was that the government has done scientific studies on the population.
Not like that, though. They're not testing things on people. In fact, there's laws to prevent it.
There are laws that protect it. You're correct. What you're saying is that the government is doing nothing wrong, ever.
No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying. The government does wrong things all the time.
Maybe people can look up, again, government testing that's been disclosed. And there's quite a long list there, in fact. And I think maybe they could make up their own mind on that. And with everything here, what he cites for data does exist. In fact, even regarding, let's go to the beginning of the conversation, global dimming, you can find data that says it isn't happening. He's right about that. But you can also find a mountain of data that says it is. In fact, I'll read you an excerpt from just published from BBC Science and Nature. We are all seeing rather less of the sun. Scientists looking at 5 decades of sunlight measurements have reached the disturbing conclusion that the amount of solar energy reaching the Earth's surface has been gradually falling. Paradoxically, the decline in sunlight may mean that global warming is far greater a threat to society than previously thought. Now, back to my own experience being in the renewable energy industry, when planes put something in the air, whatever that may be, that blocks at times 70% to 80% of my solar uptake, the sun is being blocked most definitely. So, but a mixed defense, there can find things that says it's not happening, And people simply have to look at sources of data and decide which they feel is of substance, which they feel is true, what they feel might be causing this massive spike in Alzheimer's, autism, ADD, why things won't grow, why the sun feels so hot. I think people need to decide for themselves. But, you know, there are sites to indicate on any subject, be it global warming or a lot of other things, you can find a lot of different opinions, but it's up to people to look and decide
Just real quickly on that one test you did, that was an article from 2005, which...
Which test? I'm sorry, Mick.
The BBC article that you just quoted, that was published in 2005, and it was about research from 2001 and between 2001 and 2005, but it's all based on studies of old data. So more recently, in the last, 7 or 8 years, better studies have been done, which show that there's been a great increase in the transparency of the atmosphere, specifically because of the clean air.
I think the studies compare with agencies like those that monitor the nuclear situation, that when the nuclear levels, for example, from Fukushima go through the roof, and suddenly they can't hide that anymore. They simply change the safe levels. They start to change the science around that. And
actual level. It's not a safe level. It's like, you know, is there more sun now? And, you know, the fact is that, you know, the studies that go back over the last 10, 20 years do actually show a slight decrease. The reason they were showing an increase still in the 90s was because of Mount Pinatubo, which, you're familiar with that. It was a big eruption. It put lots of particulates in the atmosphere. But because the Clean Air Act came into effect in about 90 or 91, the particulates over America in particular have been decreased. Like, you know, the car emissions and factory emissions have been going down. Now, they're actually starting to go up a little bit now because of China.
Well, if you said it's going down, though, let's cite another article, though, Mick. NOAA, 2011, NOAA study, increase in particulates high in Earth's atmosphere has offset recent climate warming. This is July 21st, 2011. There's plenty of data out there to indicate the atmosphere is full of particulates, and they just can't figure out where they're coming from. And as a very first-hand experience, again, when plane grid patterns appear over our home, we pulled flight data. There are no east-west flights, but yet we see them. And when these
couple of east-west flights over your area. I'd looked them up.
Well, you should tell the pilots here. We've just interviewed the commercial pilots and military because they've done the same, and we don't find it. But when these flights block,
I find them for you. They're flying to Hawaii, I believe, from Chicago or somewhere like that.
Well, let me finish the point then, because we have not found that data. But when these flights block 70 to 80% on some days, as much as 70 to 80% of my solar uptake, that's a very direct firsthand experience, and that's an absolute fact. So. This is something that it's hard to deny. And on the UV readings, again, when we see the bark being fried off of trees all over the forest, native trees, that's a very alarming sign.
You think two separate things.
What I'm saying,
Let me go ahead. You're saying the bark is fried off trees because there's more radiation, and you're also saying there's global dimming, which is reducing radiation. Wouldn't the global dimming also reduce the UVB?
If it's a particular day, your question is valid. And yes, in fact, it does. On a particular day when there's heavy spraying, yes, it does in fact decrease the overall. We're posting updated charts now. We just had a heavy spray day, and the total UVAB combination dropped about 25% with massive spraying. But with that spraying, as geoengineering data shows, that these particulates do shred ozone. There's no debate in the scientific community. So on the days when there's not massive spraying overhead, the UV is incredibly intense. So it's not an all-this, all-that equation. Once you damage or decimate the protective layers, then you have days when this particulate is not up there blocking anything, when the UV radiation is absolutely horrific. So a question... Go ahead, Mick.
Okay. Can I just go back to something you said earlier? But the NOAA study that you just quoted, that's the one of sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere. That is showing a variability in the sulfate aerosols. It's not showing an increase. It's showing that it's gone up over the last 10 years, but in the previous 10 years, it actually went down.
Well, that's confusing because in 2003, we just talked about that article, and you said the particulates were up, but that was from Patina 2, but they've since gone down.
This is talking about sulfate aerosols, which is a very different thing from what you're talking about. You're talking about global dimming by particulates in both, which would mostly be the troposphere, which would be pollution, things like that. Sulfate aerosols are in the highest stratosphere.
I think we have an acronym called SAG, Stratospheric Aerosol Geoengineering. I mean, this is the very proposal that we're talking about here, stratospheric, not tropospheric aerosol geoengineering, but stratospheric aerosol geoengineering, SAG.
Right.
So, again, if I could ask one question to Mick, and I would ask this. Given that we have documents going back even to the mid-60s outlining massive weather modification programs by the U.S. government, and people can look that up, given we have mountains of scientific data, proposals, not just very cautious proposals, but very urgent proposals by scientific communities to geoengineer immediately because we are in a planetary catastrophe. We have governments setting up massive frameworks for global governance of geoengineering. We see in the sky exactly what these patents describe, the express goal of blocking the sun. I know it blocks the sun because it decreases my solar uptake. I'll finish the question and you can answer. We have the same materials showing up in the ground that these patents call for. Virtually, we have a shredded ozone layer, which scientific study says would happen if they geoengineered. When every single dot connects, why wouldn't we believe this is going on, Mick? Why wouldn't we believe? Why shouldn't we believe it's going not going on? Or, you know, why wouldn't we believe it?
Well, basically because I don't think you have that evidence. So you're saying that you see things in the sky. Now, the patents for stratospheric sulfate engineering or geoengineering of some kind in the stratosphere would not leave trails that are visible. The trails that people are pointing to...
What do you base that on?
They would be spraying a powder. Or a gas, basically, sulfur dioxide.
I've never seen any geoengineering patent that says they're spray of gas. They speak of nanoparticulates, and this is...
Well, nanoparticulates is basically almost a gas. It's very, very small particulates. Because they're nano size, you can't actually see them. They're too small to...
But water accretes on these particles. Water accretes on them, and then you can see them. I mean, this is the whole premise of solar obscuration. You know, so you have stratospheric aerosol geoengineering, solar radiation management, and SAI, stratospheric aerosol injection. I mean, all these describe the same thing, spraying these particulates into the stratosphere to block the sun.
The thing is that
I just want to say one thing. I understand what both of you are saying, and I think I found something here that maybe Mick could take a look at. It's called aircraft technology and its relationship to emissions, and it clearly states that jet engines emit metal particles, including aluminum, TI, I'm not sure what that is, CR, ferrite, I guess that is, and NI and BA, and these are in parts per volume, which... at a level through the nozzle of the airplanes, and I'm looking at the document right now, so I'm not sure what the argument is there. It says that these are jet exhaust plumes and chemtrails right in the document.
They're just normal jet exhaust. It's no different from what you get out of the back of your car.
Okay, if it's normal jet exhaust, then why do we have films of KC-10s and KC-135 spraying at altitude with the nozzles visible and turning on and off? How can that be considered normal exhaust?
You don't have video of them spraying. You have video of KC-10s leaving contrails, and they turn on and off because they're moving through areas of high and low humidity.
Mick, I mean, you can chop this stuff with a knife. I mean, we have video of trails that look like they were cut with a knife. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what contrails look like.
Do you think
like.
An air mass changes that meteorologically? You think an air mass changes in the span of...
All right, let me ask you a question about that then. Have you ever seen the edge of a cloud?
No, the edge of a cloud is a different formation than definition of a condensation trail. It's completely different. A cloud
you're comparing an apple with an orange.
Hold on, let me go.
Right. A cloud is an area of high humidity. A cloud is just an air. It's a volume of the air made visible, as someone said a few hundred years ago. It's visible because the humidity is such that the water vapor in it condenses out.
What is necessary for that cloud to form, though, Mick? Particulate matter.
right?
Yes, particulate matter.
Right?
The
cloud can't form without particulate matter, can it?
The atmosphere is full of particulate matter everywhere, even in the clouds or not in the clouds. It's particulate matter everywhere. There's no shortage of particulate matter. The stuff that comes out of the back of the plane helps for the contrails to form a little bit, but if it was perfectly clean, if it was just spraying water out of the back of the plane, you'd still get a contrail because there's particulates in the atmosphere. But the point we're talking about here is that there's a gap in a contrail. Now, all the contrail is doing is revealing where in the sky the areas of humidity are. So if there's areas of humidity that are shaped like clouds, which have very sharp edges, you've seen cumulus clouds have incredibly sharp edges, why wouldn't a plane flying through that area of humidity start and stop at exactly where those boundaries are?
The turbulence alone around a passing aircraft could never make possible what you describe. It is absolutely impossible. And if what you describe is true, Mick, then how come at the same time we see an aircraft leaving a trail from horizon to horizon, we can spot, and we have on film, aircrafts flying at the same approximate altitude, leaving virtually nothing. Why is that? How is that explained?
Because it's at the same approximate altitude. It only takes a few hundred feet in difference for you to be in a different layer of the atmosphere, and it can be a very different humidity. There's been tests done in Germany where they've had two planes flying side by side. One of them leaves a trail, and the other one doesn't leave a trail because they have
flight. Then how come at the same time there's films of one of the two shutting off and leaving nothing again and starting up again?
Does,
I mean,
it is flying out of a region.
Hold on, let Mick answer. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's basically the same answer as before. There's regions of humidity. They're like clouds. If you can see any, you've seen lots of different shapes of clouds, and that's how the regions of humidity are. They're exactly the same shapes of clouds, which come in layers.
I understand is that there are pockets of air that are creating and not creating the stratospheric spread.
Yeah, there are pockets of air with
the
visible contrail formation.
Let's take that to another level then.
Okay.
And how can we see three-engine jet aircraft leaving a single trail? How come we have aircrafts that have one, maybe they have a jet engine that's mounted crooked on the plane because you can see the plume shoots far off to one side, and
the three-engine planes appear to leave one trail because the engines are basically very close together and they merge very quickly after the eighth, I think.
We have close a video of nozzles on planes with these plumes coming out. How is that explained?
I would like to see it. You have the
it's
name
there.
The,
it's there for everyone to see. And if Mick, if all this is natural, trails that look like they were cut with a knife, X in the sky, grid patterns,
like
aluminum. Wait a minute, aluminum falling on us in absolutely copious amounts, shredded ozone layer, patents, geoengineering, global governance. If all this is simply normal, then why do they need to? What's the purpose of geoengineering? Why have so many institutions tried to come up with a way to make these artificial trails if they just naturally form by themselves all the time? Why is David Keith discussing dumping aluminum in the atmosphere specifically to make these lingering, expanding trails? And why is it that when condensation, you know, again, this is a very simple example, but it's accurate. If this condensation just spreads out for days and days, why doesn't this happen when we're walking around on extremely cold mornings and, you know, our breath, should it hang in a trail behind us for 10 miles? Is that normal? Really?
Question.
Do we see that? I mean, do we see condensation?
Let me explain why it doesn't do that. It doesn't do it because your breath doesn't freeze. It's a little complicated, the science behind it, but basically the difference between a contrail and condensation from your breath is that the air isn't cold enough to freeze your breath in a way which is called homogeneously, which means without nuclei.
Mick, I want to ask you have one video on your website where the guy's basically throwing cold water in the freezing cold environment and it leaves sort of a contrail.
Yes.
And obviously it seems like it's pretty cold there. Why doesn't that just stay in the air?
Because it's falling, basically. You're looking at a very, very small thing. A jet plane's contrail is very, very large. And if you imagine he took that thing, and it wasn't just a simple cup of water, it was this huge train load of water and threw that up in the air, you would get a cloud that would kind of hang around for a lot longer. There's also other reasons as well, the particles.
As long as I've been around, I've been to the Arctic region, I've been to Lapland in Finland, I've never seen anything remotely close to anything.
It's
like
a problem
that.
Of scale. It's a problem of scale. Then you do actually see, if you go to places like Fairbanks, you'll see a thing called ice fog. Cars will actually leave a trail behind them, but because they're just tiny little things compared to a jet plane, they're just leaving this very, very faint strain. And a person, you know, they're not really going to leave a trail because they're even smaller than the car in terms of how much water they expire. But basically, the difference is just because it's freezing, and you know, it's minus 40 degrees is the temperature you need for a contrail to form. And you don't get that very often, and you don't get jet planes on the ground. But actually, jet planes on the ground do leave contrails sometimes.
Mick, you know, atmospherically, I mean, you described, for example, that there's always an explanation that a few feet of difference elevation would explain why one jet leaves no trail and one leaves one from horizon to horizon, even though they're changing in altitude as well. You described that this is all a perfectly natural phenomenon when we see we have films of aircraft, you know, clearly shutting on and off with disbursement that's coming from we see rear engine jets with trails coming from the front wing. We see
patterns in the sky.
I think he knows. You're going to say ice is on the wing, right?
No, that's what's called an aerodynamic contrail. The decrease in pressure on the top of the wing causes the water to condense. It's a well-known phenomenon.
So why would that shut on and off then? Because there's video of that shutting on and off.
Same reason. It's going in and out of areas that have high and low humidity.
Nozzles? Why do they need nozzles on the wings then?
They don't have nozzles. What you're looking at in that video is flap fairings, which are the basically little pods on the wings which contain the mechanism, like it's a big hinge, which raises and lowers the flaps for landing. It looks a bit like a nozzle, but it's not. It's a flap fairing. Ask any pilot what it is and show them that video, and they'll tell you what it is.
I've seen Evergreen airplanes with nozzles on them.
Wait a minute.
And,
speaking of Evergreen, if all this is the case, then why does Evergreen openly advertise for their 747 supertanker for weather modification, Mick? If all this metal falling on the ground, if it was always there, the dust was always there, it's always been falling, and it's just normal, then why is everything dying in the last 10 years?
I don't know why everything's dying, but, you know, things, you know, local environments get messed up for all kinds of reasons. There's pollution, there's changes in the water supply.
Why would all that metal suddenly be falling? That's my point.
The metal isn't falling. What you're seeing is just dust.
No,
all right, Mick,
you know
let's
what?
Let's get on to
Mick,
the. I want to ask one question.
Falling.
Stratospheric Wells ball seeding for reduction of cumulus clouds and such. Do you want to respond on that?
That's a patent, a proposal for geoengineering, basically.
Okay,
so,
talk about Spec Aid 8Q462 and JP8 plus 100. Can you tell us what those are for?
You know what, though, John, I hate to wander off the course, because the bottom line is the metal counts here have gone up some 50,000% over 10 years, 50,000% in a single rain event. So, you know, again, the notion that the dust is suddenly blowing or that something's changed, it doesn't hold water. The metal's coming.
Well,
you
guys may not be familiar with these terms, but I think that our viewers should listen and look these terms up. It's called Spec Aid 8Q462. And there's JP8 plus 100, which is a jet additive. It's and there's also carbon black, which is, you know, it's carbon black dust. Do you want to comment on that, Mick?
Well, carbon black isn't really an additive. It's
an anti-coking device. I understand,
but
outside of that, what does it usually do?
These things are just very, very small, like additives that are put in jet fuel, and they basically contain, you know, just some chemicals that do something like they stop things getting clogged up, and they stop static from building up.
You're talking about coking in the jet engine.
Basically, the fuel additives, like you add to your car sometimes. There's nothing unusual about them. They're usually like very complex hydrocarbons with a few chemicals in them, but they're just.
Are you familiar with ethanol?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what ethanol does to your gas engine?
Not offhand, no.
Okay. I mean, obviously, all of us are kind of being affected by ethanol in our gas tanks, but we don't know exactly what it does. A lot of theories are that what's added to the jet fuel, we don't really know what it does either. I know what ethanol does because I researched it, and maybe other people can look it up too, but what it does is it gives you worse gas mileage. It gives you the BTUs are not as high, and we're all driving around in our cars, and we don't even know what we're driving. What the effect of that 10% or 15% additive does?
You're just speculating about what might be in jet fuel. I don't think there's really
no. I'm not speculating. There are trademarked additives that we can't get access to.
Well, so you're speculating.
Why are they trademarked?
The people weren't copying them.
I want to give a closing. I want to give a closing statement because I know we could chase this around a long time, and there's some issues here that
there's a lot of issues that are not disclosed to the public, and I want to know what Mick thinks about that.
No, I know. I mean, I need.
Can he finish?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yep, Mick, just tell me what you think. Why are they keeping these additives that are in the jet fuel confidential?
Because it's a trade secret, and they don't want people to steal their formula. It's like
who would steal that exactly?
Their competitors.
How many manufacturers actually make jet fuel?
How many manufacturers make cola? There's Coke and there's Pepsi, and neither of them are giving each other their trademarks, their trade secrets. It's the same thing. It's just a.
I don't think
there's
we have
there's
that
not that many there's not that many people making jet fuel. They're all regulated by the FAA. And my thought is that if they're spraying it in our skies, we should know what it is.
Well, you were talking about
don't you agree?
There's actually a lot of jet fuel manufacturers. Jet fuel is just kerosene.
See, when you buy a can of Coke, it says that it has trade secrets in it, but those are just amounts. They still have to tell you what the ingredients are.
No, they don't.
As long as you know what I mean. So when
if
we're
if
breathing
they're
this,
amounts, they don't have to tell you what they are.
Right. So they don't have to tell you what they are,
but
we're breathing them.
Flavoring.
They do have to disclose it, and the amounts don't have to be disclosed.
I think
if we're talking about the Food and Drug Administration, they have to be disclosed. But anyway, I'll leave the word up to Mick.
If we can have a closing statement from each, John. I mean, maybe Mick could do a closing statement, and I could follow. Just a 60-second short closing statement. That's all I want.
All right.
Okay, who wants to start?
I can go. I just want to say I want to thank Dane and John for this. And I think that what we need to do is focus on the evidence and verifiable evidence, which is why I think the video of the meters would be a good idea. And I encourage people to look up all the things that we've talked about here. I'd just like to read one thing that I just saw today on an article. It was an article in the Daily Mail about contrails, and someone commented on it, and they said, I was a jet engine mechanic in the Navy, and I can assure you there is no such thing as excess water coming from jet engines. Gas turbines operate on principles described by Bernoulli and only have infinitesimal H2O content, if at all. So my point here is here's someone who's a jet engine mechanic from the Navy who doesn't know that jet engine exhaust has water in it. Be very careful about taking experts' words at face value.
Okay. I understand
Nick,
that.
Okay, and with that advice, then, for the government who tells us they're not doing this, then I would finish with this. We have patents that describe exactly what we see in the sky, the same materials falling on the ground. We have documents going back almost five decades describing this sort of program going on. We have a shredding of the ozone layer, which I will document, as Mick suggested, on film so that people can see the actual readings, although there's not a person in Northern California that doesn't feel this sun in their face. We have escalating metals in our rain that have gone up some 50,000% in some cases in the last 10 years. We have virtually every single dot connecting, and there can always be found a benign explanation for anything, everything that sounds very plausible. But if the reality on the ground shows effects that cannot be denied, I think that's what people need to base their opinion on. So I hope that anybody that's listened to this does their own investigation and starts to connect the science that they find and the information on geoengineering. I like, obviously, that term is science and not the chemtrail term. So we have every dot connecting that indicates these programs are going on. I don't think we would expect our government to ask our permission if they could do this to us, because we know them better at this point. So anyway, thank you for participating, Mick. I will definitely follow up with your suggestion to show the readings we are getting, which, again, the math is correct. I think that's one thing we cleared up from the earlier conversation. The math that we are using is a very straightforward reading for the meter, but I will film this so that you can see it, and we'll film it in each location we do it, and people can compare that data on their own to add to their picture.
All right, Mick, do you have anything else you want to add quick?
No, I do not think I do.
Thanks very much for joining us, and Dane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think
thank
this went well, and
thank you, Mick.
I think that everybody's here for the truth, and I hope that our listeners do their own research and find their truth.
Indeed.
Have a great night, guys. Thank you.
Bye.